Accession number 20375, Real 5.
You'll buy Real 5.
Yeah, we used to trade a crate of Asahi beer, I think that was the earliest form of lager, with the Americans for whatever we could get out of them. Basically, it was space heaters, winter clothing, and the strange thing with the Americans were, we carried a 38, oh, Smith & Wesson 38, or a Webley 38 pistol. Back in then those days, we used to have this attitude of Americans and British with the attitude of trading in between ourselves for what we had and what they wanted. For instance, we've had a 38, either Webley or Smith & Wesson, and that was a weapon that the Americans used to like, because I think it goes back to the American cowboys. They liked a small 38 with six shots, as opposed to the Browning automatic, and they would offer dollars or whatever for our pistol. But we have, the British soldier has got this thing about hanging on to his gun, plus the fact he also had a awful big argument with the senior ranks, usually the RQMS or the SQMS, as to what happened to it. I mean, short of being captured and coming back and saying, look, I've lost my gun, that didn't give you an excuse, unless that was the reason you were without it. Even the infantryman that came out of the line came out carrying his weapon. Whereas the Americans, there was one occasion where we were changing over and we were coming down the hill and they were putting in a couple of tanks and some infantry. And I saw this lad carrying a tripod to a heavy machine gun, and halfway up the hill it got heavy and he threw it away. And we pointed out that some poor little bugger was carrying the other half. And, oh shit man, somebody will get it. And that was the difference in attitude. Their equipment was not second hand, but it wasn't as urgent to keep their stuff intact as ours were. It was far easier for them to, as I said before, it's easier to leave it and run to save themselves than to try and bring the equipment back with them. And a classic example was an American sergeant in charge of an arms and ammunition depot where I'd gone down to pick up some 38s and Sten gun rounds, 9mm. And we were talking, and I happened to mention that I had 4 bottles of beer, and he asked me straight out what would I want for it. And I'd always looked at the short carbine, as they called it. It was a small, I suppose the nearest thing to our Sten gun, except that it was like a small rifle, carried 28 rounds in a clip. And I said I'd like a carbine. And he went away and came back with a carbine and 2 beautifully balanced clips taped together, and he handed me the carbine. I gave him 4 bottles of beer, And I carried that. In fact, I carried it right the way through into Germany, and for some reason it vanished after it had been placed in the regimental armoury because it didn't have a name on it. It's one of them things where it was an illegal weapon, as I suppose they'd call it now, a souvenir, as it was back in them days. Coming on this sort of thing, when we were coming into Southampton Harbour on the way home, we were pulled up in the Narrows, and the word went out that the customs and excise people were coming on board. At first we didn't worry about it, and then the word filtered down to the ship. They were looking for illegal weapons, arms, whatever. And you could almost see the boat coming up out of the water. Stuff was being thrown over the other side of the boat from where these people were. And as I say, I'd put the carbine into the ship's armoury. So that was quite safe. But a Turkov pistol that I picked up from a dead Chinaman, which was a little Russian pistol, I had in my belt. And I worked on the principle that they would only search our bedding and our kit. And sure enough, we came out of our sleeping quarters, because we were all... The boat we came home on was the Canberra, and she was a big boat. It was four men to a cabin. But as we came out, there was one chap there who frisked us, and he found it. So I never did know what happened to that. And we used to get away with trading with the Americans. It was almost as though it was an unwritten law. In fact, when we came back to Britannia Camp outside Busan to come home, and I said that we were handing over from us to them, we were tossing the stuff that we didn't need to go home with, such as the anoraks and the hunting caps with the flaps that we picked up from the Americans, and we were passing it to our opposite number in the vehicle. When their CO came along and said, what was all this stuff that we were giving? And we pointed out that it was coming up to the second winter. And he said, well, they don't need it. My chaps will survive with what the British Army has been issued with. And we thought, oh my God, we've got one of them that doesn't know what's going to happen when it really happens. But whether they kept it or whether he did burn it, which is what he threatened to do, we never knew. I know one lad certainly slung my tank suit and anorak into the side bin of my tank without actually sort of tossing it onto the heap as he was told to do.
Did you do any trading with troops of any other nationality?
No. Basically, because even the Aussies were pretty much the same equipment level as the British Army. You know, they had the heavy overcoat and the woolens and that sort of thing. The only people that seemed to have everything that was needed were the Americans. But then I suppose that's been the same wherever I've been with the American forces. They've always seemed to have everything that they needed. Whereas we would work out a system of, if you haven't got enough, then you stretch what you've got. They have always got more than enough and can always use a, leave a surplus behind, and it doesn't matter because we can always get some more further down the road. And it, you know, in the British Army it didn't work like that. I don't think it ever worked like that. The only thing that we seemed to get enough of was ammunition. Ammunition and petrol, we had no problems whatsoever. But at some, I can't remember where, at one stage we switched from British C rations to the American K ration, and I don't know why. And that was when we discovered that. Now that, it's funny because I was talking to some chaps at a BKVA meeting about that, and they were saying how different the food was and how they disliked the American standard of food compared with the British rations. And it's got to be a matter of taste, because I thought they, that stuff was wonderful. And I mean, ours was beans, which was probably Heinz beans, whereas theirs was beans and pork and beans and bacon and beans. In fact, a very true and very amusing story was a chap called Stan Hargreaves, who was an inveterate letter writer. He would write on any subject for any reason. And we were sitting having breakfast one morning, and he suddenly said, "Have you looked at this?" I said, "What's up now?" "This pork and beans." I said, "What about it?" I said, "There's no pork." I said, "What do you mean there's no pork?" He says, "I've just been through this dinner beans." He says, "There's no pork. I'm going to write to him." And he turns the tin round, and there it is, Chicago Canning Company, Illinois. So he writes to the managing director, and he dashes off this letter of our complaint. "There we are fighting for the principles of the Charter of the United Nations, and we don't get pork in the pork and beans." And we, you know, oh, that's him, he's away again. And I suppose it must have been 6 weeks. And he got this packet. And there was 12 tins of pork and beans, which was more pork than beans. And this gorgeous letter from this chap saying he was terribly sorry, and that he was sure that the Allies that were fighting for the freedom of the world, because, I mean, Americans were well over the top with communism anyway, it would never happen again, that their quality control had been updated. And he would do this sort of thing with anything. There was a picture of a girl on Picture Post. Do you remember? Can you remember the magazine Picture Post?
Yes, I can.
She was the most gorgeous creature we had ever seen. And Stan looked at her and said, "Oh, that's the girl I'm going to marry." So, "Oh, good, I'm going to write to her." So he wrote to the editor of Picture Post asking for the girl's name and address so that he could write to her. And he gets a letter back. "Very nice. We're terribly sorry, but we can't give the name and address to our models. But we have passed your name and address to her, and if she wishes to get in touch, she will." And months later, he got just as a one-off letter from this girl saying how sweet to hear from him and that she was so pleased. And that, you know, that was it. It just petered out of that. But he was a character. He would write. It would either be something like the name of the girl or to complain bitterly for any reason. If it wasn't right, then it wasn't right, and he would put it. He should have become a politician, I think.
What was his name?
Stan Hargreaves. Lance Corporal Stan Hargreaves. And he was T2 Troop B Squadron. and a character.
You were telling me earlier about the things you found on enemy dead, like weapons, but did you find anything more personal?
We never looked. When I say we... The rule one, which was hammered home to us very, very early, was you don't touch a body. Because 99.9% of them were all booby-trapped. And we were in one position. I think it was the first day or second day that we'd arrived at this little league called, as I said, Mistletoe Orchard. And we were told to stay within the confines of this area. And like most soldiers, the first chance we got, we started walking around to see what was going on outside. The basic belief of a soldier is if you're told to stay here, there's got to be something that you're not to be looking at outside, so you go and have a look. And we climbed up a gradual slope to some rocks, and there was these two Chinamen crouched over the rocks with their rifles. And me and this buddy, Nobby Clark, turned around and he was leading the way, and I suddenly heard him saying, "Surrender." And I thought, is he surrendering or are we surrendering? And he was nattering away to this thing. And we walked around and we suddenly realised, I said, "Oi, they're dead." And he said, "They're dead." And they were just slumped over the edge of this rock and still got their rifles, but the backs of their heads were gone. They'd been caught this in the front, and the back of their head was missing. And I said, "Yeah, they're well dead." So he said, "Oh," and that's when it dawned on us why we'd been told never to touch a body. Because the first thing you do is you go to have a look. But as we got close, I could see it was very badly done. There was a tripwire, and I said, "There's a wire down there, and there we." So we legged it back down and told the troop sergeant we got some bodies on the hill. And he said, "Well, don't worry about that. That is not our job." I can't remember who used to follow us up. I suppose it must have been the Pioneer Corps, who used to come along and do all that sort of thing. But where you found a body that was obviously not rigged up, and then you'd look through basic. I mean, we looked, and even in the winter, all they had was the very first what is now called trainers. That was what they used to wear all the year round. And we suddenly realised that apart from their flock jackets and slacks, they were worse off for fighting the weather than we were in that initial stages. And I took a volunteer job, something soldiers don't do normally. But we were out of the line, and we was re-kitting and whatnot, and they wanted four men to look after this prison compound. And a corporal and three. And we went down there. And these chaps were how can you say it without being totally... I'm not trying to be rude when I say that they were peasants. They had no education. We had a chap called Wang who spoke Korean and a smattering of Chinese, and he was the our interpreter. And we were talking to the people in this compound. There was about 30 of them, I suppose. And he was... Wang was educated. He'd been to Seoul University, and he spoke faultless English, which was surprising. And he was saying that these Chinese didn't even know that they were in Korea. They were convinced they were still at home in China, and that we were attacking them. And we'd always looked at them. You either saw thousands of them in daylight, which means that you didn't see anybody, because they were just a mass coming at you, or they came in the dark. That bloody silver trumpet that always heralded the attack was going to come in. And that you probably heard about the little girl on the Imjin battle.
No.
She could scream in English, and it was eerie. You were waiting for it to start. You knew it was going to happen. We'd been told that the battle was going to start. We opened up with a barrage, and then the deadly silence when the guns stop, and you wait, and you could hear this girl. And it was a young girl, and she was shouting, and I can't remember what it was she was shouting, except that you were going to die. She was telling us that we were all going to die. And then the trumpets start. And I'm not sure what the trumpet was, whether it was just a noise to scare us to let us know they were coming, or whether it was an actual battle call that put their troops into action. But when that thing started and all hell broke loose, and the battle joined, and I think I've said that we fired more rounds in that 24 hours than any other squadron, including the Royal Artillery. And it's a funny thing, but it stops and starts battles. There is never the ordinary soldier on the ground. I suppose somebody knows what's going on, but the ordinary soldier doesn't. Somebody tells you to start firing now, and you start firing now. And you keep on firing until somebody says, all right, stop firing now. So you stop firing now. And all that noise and all that sound and dirt flying and everything else stops. And you then discover that you're either going to go forward or you're going to go back. And if you go back, it means that you've lost a bit of ground. And if you go forward, it means you've won a bit of ground. But you still don't know what the whole thing was all about, apart from the fact that somebody told you to fire an awful lot of ammunition for an awful lot of money for no reason. And you come to the point, oh, that would be, and I'm still here. And I think that was it when we got the word to pull out of the line, and we were ready to think. The word had come down that we were going home. And there is, you've heard it all before. We've been going home for about 4 months, we were going home. We're going home. The word's out. We're all going home. We're coming. And then one lunchtime, the RSM gathered us all around and he said, right, we are moving down to Britannia Camp outside Poussin and handing over to the 5th Inniskillen Dragoon Guards. Yeah, we've heard this one before. He said, so we want everybody to start packing now. And we thought, it could be on. This could really be true this time, because he's told us, and he don't usually tell fibs. And sure enough, we pulled out a line, and as we pulled out, the Americans pulled in. And we trundled off down into we went on flats. We went on the railway. But we stormed into Britannia Camp, which is, it's like when a soldier says Britannia Camp, if anybody knows barracks in the UK and you think of beautiful buildings with showers and what, forget it. This was a mud compound with some Nissen huts. But at least we were undercover for the first time. And we had 2 days of, as I said, degunging, cleaning, scrubbing down, getting the tanks ready to hand over to the new lad. And they seem to pack up and go almost as with the ease that we'd moved in, and that left us suddenly with nothing to do. And then the word went out we were going to be kitted with brand new battle dress and tailored and neat and tidy and whatever. And we came out and each jacket had 2 medal ribbons sewn onto the, and we suddenly realised that from then on we were entitled to wear these. Embarrassment, believe it or not. You sort of looked at this bit of ribbon on your chest and then looked at the bloke opposite, and he got 2 ribbons on his chest. And you think, well, what do we get these for? Because it was just a piece of ribbon. And we then got the word that we were going to board the ship and we were going home. And it was a pleasure cruise coming back. There was no doubt about it. We got to, I think it was Ceylon, and we had the choice. We could either lay over at Ceylon, which was Christmas Eve, and we could spend the time ashore, or we could carry on. We'd just rewater and carry on and get home 24 hours earlier. And everybody decided that we'd go home early. And we came in early. Or rather, we saw England early. And for some reason, we'd sailed from Southampton, but we came into port in Liverpool, which was about as far away as you, from Tibworth as you could park a bus.